Okay, next we're going to hear from the Department of Public Instruction. We have Laura Adams, the Policy Initiatives Advisor for the State Superintendent, Wei Wen, Assistant Superintendent for the Division of Academic Excellence, and Tom McCarthy, the Executive Director for the Office of the State.
Well, good morning. Thank you for inviting the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction to appear before this body today to make policy recommendations for early reading. My name is Yui Nguyen again, and I'm joined as Assistant State Superintendent of Division of Academic Excellence. Department staff joining me today to testify include Policy Initiatives Advisor Laura Adams and Tom McCarthy, the Executive Director. Before I continue, I just want to thank Dr. Seinberg for his testimony. We agree on many things. We agree that we still have a lot to learn as how to implement, how to look at best practices. We agree that teachers need to be part of the plan for this, and they need to be on board, as Dr. Seinberg spoke about. And then we also agree that we can't put everything in one basket because we know that this is a complex issue. So thank you, Dr. Seinberg. So I'm honored to be the Assistant State Superintendent role as this crucial time in Wisconsin's educational story. Prior to this, I have served as a preschool teacher, a kindergarten teacher, a librarian, and a principal. I'm also a dad of two young children, one almost turning four, who is learning to read, and a fourth grader who is reading to learn. From these many perspectives, I understand these roles are all central in teaching of reading to our youngest students. Teaching includes many things: learning each child's strengths, studying and respecting how they learn, and supporting their natural lens of curiosity. We take all of these things and apply them to reading. We must provide opportunities and tools for students to learn to read. I am certain no one in this room is satisfied with reading outcomes for students in Wisconsin, which is why I'm confident we will improve when we work together. The department has been actively discussing areas where we agree on policy recommendations with both Republican and Democrat members of our legislature, and the recommendations you hear today reflect those conversations. We each have a role to play in working towards our shared goal that all Wisconsin students are readers. We believe there are places we can make policy to have impact. Supporting our teachers to be competent and confident by creating policy focused on instructional materials and educator preparation. Revising our statute on the reading readiness screener and leveraging Dr. Underley's budget to fund statewide reading coaches and support evidence-based early reading instruction. With that, I will have Ms. Adams share with you these recommendations in greater detail.
Thank you. Good morning. As Assistant State Superintendent Yui Nguyen stated, we need to improve reading in Wisconsin. We are all in agreement on that. And we have been working in a bipartisan way to come up with policy solutions to directly impact reading achievement in a positive way for the state of Wisconsin. Our first recommendation is in the area of ensuring that we have a competent and confident teacher workforce in Wisconsin. At the Department of Public Instruction, we have been paying very close attention to what other states have been doing, and especially those states that have been making gains in early reading achievement. We know that many of those states, including Mississippi, Louisiana, Tennessee, Michigan, Nebraska, and many others, are now maintaining a list of recommended instructional materials in English language arts, which includes early reading, and mathematics K-12. Therefore, our first recommendation is that Wisconsin also develop and maintain a list of recommended instructional materials, including those instructional materials that include evidence-based early reading instructional practices. By maintaining such a list, we would be empowering our teachers to be able to focus on the how of teaching rather than the what, which is something that Dr. Seidenberg was referring to in his presentation. At the same time, it is important for us to recognize that simply giving educators different materials will not automatically equate to gains in reading achievement. Our educators need ongoing professional learning and supports in order to implement changes that may be uncomfortable for them. Therefore, our policy recommendation is at the same time to attend to the need to provide ongoing professional learning and supports to educators to use those new materials or to implement those evidence-based reading instructional practices. There's room for differentiation here within this policy recommendation. We could, for example, choose to provide more intensive supports to those school districts and independent charter schools that are experiencing the most extreme opportunity or achievement gaps. Or we could choose to direct our most intensive supports to those districts and independent charter schools that are consistently seeing the lowest proficiency rates among their youngest learners. Our second policy recommendation, again, is in the area of ensuring that we have a competent and confident teacher workforce, and it is directly related to our educator preparation programs. We know that in Wisconsin, we have an existing state statute that identifies some of the components of evidence-based early reading instruction that educator preparation programs are required to include in their coursework. In addition to that, of course, we have the Wisconsin Foundations of Reading test that our teachers must pass in order to gain initial licensure. What we know is that state statute that identifies the components of early reading instructional, evidence-based early reading instruction that needs to be included in our educator preparation coursework is quite old at this point. Our recommendation is to review that state statute, make sure that it accurately identifies all of the evidence-based early reading instructional practices that should be included in our EPP coursework. At the same time, we also know that just like in the K-12 system, our instructors and ed prep programs also need ongoing professional learning and supports. What we see is that in Mississippi, one of the things that they did was they offered professional learning on evidence-based early reading instructional practices to their instructors in their ed prep programs. Mississippi and Michigan also provide specific resources that need to be included in their ed prep programs in the area of reading. So, again, we hope that this policy recommendation includes some supports for our ed prep programs rather than just a stick or a law or a statute. At this time, I also really want to make a connection here to Wisconsin Motion 57. Wisconsin Motion 57, of course, outlines exactly what DPI must do with our state set-aside portion of ESSER III funds. One of the line items in Wisconsin Motion 57 directly connects to our ed prep programs and reading. It states that Wisconsin will contract with a vendor who will conduct an analysis of reading program coursework in our UW institutions. After engaging in our very robust and required state procurement process, the Department of Administration selected a vendor for that work. That vendor is TPIUS. Today, March 2nd, ironically, National Read Across America Day, that vendor is meeting with the deans of our schools of education in the UW system in order to provide details and timelines about that opportunity. The other thing that Motion 57 provides for is additional funds for grants for those UW systems that want to make changes to their courses based on the findings and the report of that vendor, TPIUS. I bring this to your attention to remind us of an existing policy that is currently in the early stages of implementation that could also have a real impact on reading achievement in Wisconsin. We are definitely taking both and approaches in every step of the way. Our third recommendation is in the area of assessment. Many states followed Wisconsin's lead by requiring a reading readiness screener for all students in grades 4K through grade 2. At the same time, that 2014 statute was revised in 2016 to allow each independent charter school and school district to select their own reading readiness screener. We agree that having a reading readiness screener to identify those learners who need additional supports in their reading development is critical and invaluable. But it is only valuable if our educators know how to act on the data and the results of that screener. One of the drawbacks of now having so many different screeners in the state is that DPI is not able to provide professional learning opportunities to our educators about how to use the data from that screener in order to intervene and tailor their instruction to the needs of our learners who need it the most. Therefore, our recommendation in this area is to actually revert back to the 2014 statute that requires one common reading readiness screener for the state, and also providing an appropriation for professional learning funds so that we can provide the supports to our educators so that they know how to act on the data appropriately to intervene and support our developing readers at the youngest grades. You have already heard us talk about the need for professional learning supports to make some of these policy recommendations effective. We also know that many states that have seen increases in early reading achievement have invested in a combination of both evidence-based trainings as well as professional learning and coaches. Mississippi employs 78 regional reading coaches to support its teachers in implementing new instructional materials and in implementing those evidence-based early reading instructional practices. We know that Motion 57 also allowed all of our school districts a one-time grant opportunity to allow them to participate in either letters or another evidence-based reading training. And the vast majority of our districts and independent charter schools are currently engaged in that training through those funds provided through Motion 57. But the piece that's missing is that support piece. I think that many of us can think of a time that we were required to sit in a training and then just went back to our jobs and just did the same old after we were done. That's why we believe that training piece is so critical. The state superintendent's budget proposal closed that loophole by offering a suggested appropriation, asking for an appropriation for 26 regional coaches throughout the state of Wisconsin in order to provide those ongoing learning supports, either to implement new curricula or to support our educators in implementing those evidence-based early reading instructional practices. In addition to that, our state superintendent's budget proposal includes funds for targeted community-based programs, including ones that Dr. Seidenberg mentioned, Wisconsin Reading Corps and Literacy Lab. Those particular community-based programs would specifically be targeted for those areas of the state where we're seeing the greatest achievement gaps or the most persistent low proficiency levels of our students. Therefore, we hope that you advocate for these particular budget items in order to support early reading in Wisconsin. At this time, I'm actually going to turn the presentation over to my colleague, Tom McCarthy, so that he can talk a little bit more about how we can leverage the budget process in order to support early reading achievement in Wisconsin.
Thanks, Laura and Yui. So I get to be the guy that brings the bad news to you, because I think there's a ton of opportunity in this conversation, and I think you're going to hear a lot of what we said today and what Dr. Seidenberg said reflected in Dr. Burke and in the Luxembourg-Casco reading specialist that is going to be talking to you last. But I got to bring some of the real reality, which is that our schools are in dire straits in terms of a need for revenue growth to be able to sustain some of the stuff that we're talking about here. What we don't want to see is a very good conversation about reading that you all drop in money in a one-time or even a weaning fashion that goes away, and then all of the results and performance disappear. And the way around that is by investing in our school districts. It is by letting them catch back up with real inflationary needs And it's by helping them solve the fiscal cliff that we created in the state together around use of emergency pandemic relief dollars. Right now, they're sustaining operations across the state, and they're plugging in one-time costs, and that bill is going to come due in 2024 when that money disappears. So it's a real warning, and we need your help. Because when we talk to superintendents, board members, and communities about this, they're terrified. They don't want to spend those dollars and then watch all of the things that they're investing in disappear tomorrow when that money goes away. Related to that is the state's continuing real need to have an investment in special education reimbursement rates. When we're talking about special education, I think a lot of people have a thing in their mind that is the average special education student or student experiencing disabilities. And I'm here to dispel you of that myth and say that most of the kids who qualify for those services at some time in their career will exit those services. A lot of those kids are the kids who are struggling to read. If we want to make a real investment that is going to be sound, we need to end the practice of shifting money around in school districts to make sure that their guarantees are being made on the special education side at the cost of other kids. That is not fair to districts, and we need to do something to plug that hole. I'm here to tell you that we want to engage with all of you on a conversation that continues forward around mental health and well-being in our communities. And I'm also going to be vulnerable and tell you that I'm not sure schools are the answer to that. But right now, they are sort of the front door delivery service, and they're not equipped to be. So if we want to look at funding counties for those services, if we want to look at funding school districts, actual private providers, I do not care. The issue is so tremendous, and we need to get our arms around it. And I think when you put all of these things together, if we're actually making those sorts of sound investments in issues that you all care about, like reading, issues that we're telling you school districts need, like revenue growth, a change in special education reimbursement rates, and figuring out a solution to this mental health crisis, you'll see an easing of the workforce crisis that I'm sure superintendents and school boards have told you about. We can't find reading teachers. We can't find special education teachers. It's because they can't, A, afford them, and B, the job is not as attractive because of the tremendous weight that lives in schools to solve society's problems. So sorry, I'm really excited about this reading conversation. I think we've got some really positive work. I want to commend Chairman Kitchens, Chairperson Jagler, for digging in with us. I know we're not seen all over the legislature as like the great unifier. You probably think of us as a bunch of wild hippies, but we care deeply about this, and we're willing to work with whoever shows up in genuine ways, and we don't necessarily care whose name goes on the homework. We just want to get stuff done for kids. So I hope you take that seriously. We want to be your partners. And I'm going to kick it back over to Yui to kind of close us out here.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Tom, for connecting the dots and making sure that we see the broader picture. So in that same vein, I'm going to try and make some connections here as well. So it's important to note that these recommendations for improving early reading achievement can be strengthened by connecting them. For example, if Wisconsin utilizes a single reading readiness screener, resources and how to use the results to inform instruction could be a part of professional learning that is used in educator prep programs. As a result, new teachers would already have the skills and knowledge to utilize the screener to support reading development. If Wisconsin develops and maintains a list of recommended instructional materials, those instructional materials could be utilized in educator prep programs as well, resulting in a workforce that already has a familiarity with specific evidence-based early reading instruction. Our school systems are ecosystems. Everything affects everything. As a principal, I experienced this firsthand. Our goal was to improve outcomes for our kids, especially reading. And yet, there were so many competing demands for my time. Are there enough teachers to staff every classroom today? That was a daily conversation. Handfuls of students are arriving late to school, checking in, making sure that they're okay, and they are ready to learn. Who's able to get to the classroom quickly that needs extra support to address the significant mental health concerns for a particular student? As a principal, I am that extra support. I know we talked about change, but I think our educators and our administrators are used to change. We step into that school, the only thing that we know is that we will expect the unexpected. They need us to do our part to enact policies that allow educators to think, to learn, and to grow their skills without tipping them over. So in conclusion, we support our teachers by creating policies focused on instructional materials and educator prep programs, revising our statute on the reading readiness screener and leveraging Dr. Unnelie's budget to fund reading coaches and support evidence-based early reading instruction. Thank you for your attention, and now we'd like to take some of this time to answer your questions.
Okay, well, thank you all for being in here today. Appreciate it, and I appreciate that we've had a lot of conversations about this, and frankly, I was surprised at the beginning of the session when I reached out that we were as much in agreement as we have been. With the reading coaches, and I won't ask a lot of questions. Most of these we've talked about, but with the reading coaches, how do you envision that, though, to hire these people? Where are they going to come from? And it would seem that the most effective coaches are, and again, we'll hear from the one from Luxembourg Casco, are the ones that are within that school district. And for us, you know, as a state, out of the state budget, I can't imagine this being an ongoing problem. We need to retrain teachers and provide the coaching, but we can't, you know, hopefully then once the universities step up and are teaching as they should be, we won't have to continue that. But anyway, how do you envision that with the coaches, I guess?
I think that the first thing that we, again, want to recognize is the fact that Mississippi, which has a fewer number of schools than Wisconsin, employs 78, and we are asking for 26 coaches in the state superintendent's budget proposal at $10 million a year. So that's the first thing that really needs to be acknowledged. Given that, and obviously knowing that those coaches would not be able to be in every school in the state, it's about targeting our resources to where they are needed. It's true that we may have expert educators who may be interested in transitioning into a coaching role and applying for those positions. I think that there are many different forms that the implementation of that policy could take. Mississippi, their State Department employs those coaches directly. We know we also have regional technical assistance centers in the form of what we call our CESAs in the state. We could certainly look to our CESAs and think about some models where we are also utilizing some existing resources through those centers. I think that there are many different ways that this could look.
Can I just jump in and hammer home the thing that Laura was finishing on there, is that we need our regional partners. We need people, boots on the ground in schools, to be able to do this effectively. And as I've kind of tried to drag out for you all, there's kind of a policy tension of time and magnitude that exists on that same continuum of cost. If you want this to be more intensive, go faster, and be offered to more schools in a timely fashion, it's going to be more expensive. If we wanted to bite the elephant in small chunks, we can do it in a cheaper way. And that's where we need you all as partners to tell us, like, where's the appetite for this? How much elephant do you want to eat today?
Okay, thanks. And I will say, one piece I had not heard before was that you are now working with the curriculum with the colleges and universities. That's encouraging because, I mean, that's going to...
That's a recommendation.
Yeah. Okay. It sounded like you had started some of that, no?
Motion 57 allows for some work to be done in our ed prep programs with an outside vendor. The State Department of Ed has always been there to be an available partner, but that partnership has not always been as formal in this area as perhaps we would like it to be. And so that is one of our recommendations.
Okay, thanks. Senator Chagler, do you have anything?
Yeah, thank you. Probably, I wish I had it in front of me, that or up on the screen, the recommendation number one.
Instructional materials?
Yes. And the recommendation was, as you said, identify a list of recommended. Don't you already have that in some degree? Because I was just looking at the Wisconsin Center for Educational Research found that you have identified 80% or 79% of the school districts in the state aren't following what you already have recommended to some degree. Or can you just explain that a little bit?
So I think the tension that we're trying to lay out for you all is that we've historically been a local control state. And as we've tried to push into this conversation through activities like what we call the Instructional Materials Professional Learning, or IMPL, which is the resource you're citing, it's been sort of listless, because what good does it get us for the State Department to say your curriculum materials don't align to something that the national SEAs that are having more strength to be able to do this provide.
So to that end, if you've already kind of identified some that you would recommend, and they're not the local, we are a local control state. I ran for state senate, not for Watertown School District School Board. But having said that, if 80% of the school districts aren't recommending what you put out there on a general level, would you then support a type of bill that had included a package that eliminated some of the bad programs and curriculum, the queuing method, Fountainess and Pinnell, as the professor recommended? Would you agree to give a thumbs up to that, at least eliminating the bad ones as he recommended?
As you said, we have approached this in a very general way, in a very soft way. It was not ever formalized. We have some general resources. When school districts have called us to ask for our guidance, we point them in the direction of those resources. And we absolutely are interested in formalizing that further and doing what other states have done, like Mississippi, and really creating a more formal recommended list.
So you would support putting a thumb on the scale of a local district? Because you know how this is. The local curriculum sellers, the peddlers, if you want, depending on the bad ones, they have a lot of razzle-dazzle, and they come in and they overwhelm these local administrators. And if you don't have the authority as DPI, you've clearly stated you don't, we do. So would you support that as being part of this overall package?
I mean, I think the devil's in the details, right? We would love to sit down and continue the conversations that we've been having with Representative Kitchens, and I think you could be part of that group. We would love to have you in that group, because what you're talking about could be a very real implementation challenge with very real costs to some of these local districts. And then how are we making sure that that district that we have impacted doesn't just drive down into, as Dr. Seidenberg said, check-the-box type activities to make sure that they can operate? So, I mean, I think the easy answer from you would be to say, oh, yeah, this is great, let's sign on tomorrow. But I think we need to be very cognizant of that. As Yui said, it's complicated. The stuff is more challenging than just simply legislate with magic wand. But we want to be part of the conversation.
Senator Quinn, I believe, had a question.
Yeah. Excuse me. Thank you for being here. And it goes on the lines of Senator Jagler's questions. I guess I was a little confused then. So there is some list you sort of maintain now that you do recommend or not? And my other question is, why don't you just do that? You mentioned Wisconsin should follow suit, that other states do that, Mississippi, Michigan. Why don't you just do that now? You don't need us to do that, right? So can we maintain that list or recommend that? So I have a district that just recently in the last couple of years started moving in the science of reading direction. And I asked them, and they were pretty much on their own doing that, knowing what they're doing wasn't working. And so that would be my question, is why don't you maintain that list now then, if that's a recommendation for us?
Right now, we are pointing to what other states do. I think it would be more useful to have a recommended list that is endorsed by Wisconsin based on criteria that Wisconsin develops.
Right.
And I do see that as being a difference.
And I think your policy question, why don't we do it right now, is we do not have the legal authority to do it. We can't go into a district and say, you must take this reading.
Right. And I'm not saying – that's not even what she just suggested is – why don't you have the list now of this is what we do recommend? Not saying DPI can make us take it, but what's keeping you from doing that right now?
As I said, right now we point to other states, and we point to the criteria that other states are using. And so districts certainly could, are free to use those. The other thing that we know is that there are many of our districts that are currently using their ESSER III ARP dollars to invest in new curriculum. And including our five largest districts in the state. And we know that those are the resources that they're using to select instructional materials. I think that what we want to do is formalize that, as I said, and make sure that we're not just pointing to the work of other states, but that we're doing the work of having the hard conversation in Wisconsin of what are the criteria that's important to Wisconsin and putting that together in a formal way.
And I think the other thing, we're talking about a paradigm-shifting conversation, the approach of an SEA in the state of Wisconsin. And we're also dealing with some tenuous political straits where sometimes in certain areas, if we sneeze the wrong direction, we get sued by someone. So we want to come here with you and have this conversation openly that we're willing to make a paradigm shift, but we also don't want to get ourselves in hot water with that situation if we're going to push in a way that is not in collaboration and lockstep with the things that this body wants.
The other thing that I would add is at the same time, we absolutely want to learn from those districts that are doing well in reading. And so one of the things that we want to explore is what are the instructional materials that are being used in those districts that are doing well in reading. And they're not always the instructional materials that are showing up on the list of other states. And so that's part of the reason why we need to investigate this a little bit further in order to really develop our own criteria, I think.
I guess just to follow up on that, what do you need from the legislature to be able to do that, right? Because I don't think there's anything preventing you from, you know, if one of my districts calls you and say, hey, what are you recommending? You know, this is what we've seen other states here. If you're going to buy a new curriculum and go down a road, you should do this, right? So is there anything that prevents that now? Or are you just saying we're just in the early process of doing that?
There's nothing that prevents that now. There's not many districts that reach out to us and ask that now. By saying, here's Wisconsin's recommended list, that would really force our districts to pay more attention to us.
Sure. And just one more follow-up, if I could. On the proposed 26 positions, I don't know if we call them reading specialists or reading coaches, mimicking somewhat what Mississippi does. You've highlighted, going back to Representative Kitchen's point, you know, how would that play out? But part of the problem we've heard from the doctor before is, we already have reading specialists in schools now. We already have different forms of districts trying to do those things, but it comes back to who are those people and how are they trained, right? So how would we know that adding 26 positions to go into districts to help them maybe make a shift, I mean, who's determining who those 26 people are and what is their educational background, or are we just exacerbating what's already going on? How would that play out if that were to go forward?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good question. I think that when we look at the state of Mississippi example, that's why it is their State Department of Education that employs those coaches. Their State Department of Education then has control over the training. They provide a specific evidence-based early reading instructional training to those coaches before they deploy them out into the schools. And the other thing that I think is important to lift up here is that we do have an existing state statute that requires that every school district in Wisconsin employ a district reading specialist. The state statute does not say anything about the FTE that should be included in that district reading specialist. And, of course, there's no funding to go along with that. And someone who has a district reading specialist license that's actually an administrative license. And so, in theory, if I am a teacher and I engage in that advanced coursework to get that advanced administrative degree, I probably want a payoff for that, right? Because now I have some really specialized knowledge. And right now, our districts are not in the position of being able to provide appropriate salaries. And so, because of that, the way that our school districts actually implement that state statute is in a variety of ways. Some of our school districts do employ a district reading specialist who operates exactly as that person should. Some of our school districts employ someone and 0.15 of that individual's contract is to serve as the district reading specialist, and 0.85 of that person's contract is to be the third grade teacher, because what they really need is a third grade teacher. And what does that mean? That means that person, even if they have the right license and the right expertise and the right knowledge, they're not able to function in the way our state statute says that they should be functioning as a district reading specialist. Others of our districts will contract with our regional service providers, the CESAs, and many of our CESAs employ staff who have that license and then contract out small amounts of their time to their districts so that the district can provide those statutorily required services. So while we do have that state statute in existence, I would also argue that it's not actually being implemented in a way that's effective right now, ultimately, for our educators or our students.
I'm going to ask just a little follow-up related to that. Clearly, one of the things that's going to need to take place is enforcement, and that hasn't been a strong suit for DPI over the years. And I think Dr. Seidenberg alluded to it, that what we don't want is districts saying, oh, yeah, we're doing science of reading, and they're not really doing that. So are you guys prepared to take on a little more enforcement role if we're going to put these things into place to make sure that what we're paying for is actually what's happening?
I think that there are many ways that we can explore accountability in each of the different recommendations that we have offered up. When I think about that recommendation regarding the reading readiness screener, for example, perhaps a place of accountability would be to explore the idea of having our school districts create an individualized reading plan for each student that falls below benchmark on the screener, very clearly articulating exactly how they are going to serve the needs of that reader. So I think there are ways that we can explore accountability in each of those different recommendations.
Okay. Representative Shelton.
Can I just tail on to that, though, a little bit? The other problem that you're going to run into with the accountability question is we have 421 school districts, and you're talking about a system where we're cracking open data and information and conversations with a lot of human beings. And right now, implementing all of the federal funding that we have and doing all of this extra work that's come through the pandemic, which we love, we did not get the significant amount of funding that we needed to do that in a very high-quality level. So I just don't now want to repeat that mistake again. If we get into a conversation about accountability, we're going to need something in terms of human capacity to do this. Even if we ship it out to CISAs, you don't like us, we suck at accountability, sure, great. Someone's got to do the work. Otherwise, it is empty, hollow accountability, which is exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, again, when we look at other states, Wisconsin currently employs 2 full-time literacy specialists to serve 421 public school districts and over 30 independent charter schools. Mississippi employs 3 full-time staff that are just focused on K-3 reading, just K-3 reading. Massachusetts, which is smaller than Wisconsin, employs 5 literacy-focused staff. So that's, yeah, it is a good point to just take a look at the different resources in how those resources are being deployed in those states that are seeing reading gains.
Okay, before I turn it over to Representative Shelton, I think what I'd like to do, if it works for you guys, it's like 11:52, is at noon, bring on Dr. Burke and let her, and then if you guys are around and can come back up if there are questions following that, I don't want to cut her off. So, Representative Shelton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, I have 7 minutes. Okay. So the first thing, I would like to just make a general recommendation to our members here that I think another step beyond today would be to hear directly from those in the teacher prep programs in the state to hear more about those efforts and how we can support them and learn more about what they're doing to teach the teachers that actually are in the classroom. So just a flag. The other thing I want to mention is that, you know, the curriculum conversation is really tough because it's incredibly expensive for districts. For a district like Green Bay, which is in my district, it would cost millions of dollars. And so I think we have to really keep at the forefront of our mind, there is a significant need, if we're going to invest in reading and literacy, to fully fund these programs. Because as we heard from Dr. Seidenberg, a curriculum itself is not going to solve the problem, right? It is about supporting our teachers so that they have the foundational content knowledge and the pedagogical best practices in their toolbox. And the best way we can teach and support our students is by having the best teachers with the best toolbox and the best professional development in the classroom. But what I want to ask you all today is about the workforce challenges, right? We have our teachers right now are burnt out. They're anxious. They're reporting high levels of stress. They're leaving the classroom in high numbers after 5 years. We got an email a few weeks ago from a reading specialist who said she was being moved out of that role during the day to cover in subclasses because of the staffing challenges and the substitute challenges. So when I think about this, for me, it's really a workforce focus. I was doing a little bit of research about what some other states are doing. Indiana $111 million for phonics-focused instruction, $85 million for teacher training, $1,200 for stipends. And what I was thinking about is if we are investing in teachers, but we don't address the retention issue, then we are significantly investing in people who are going to walk out the door because they're anxious and stressed out and burnt out. So I'm wondering how you can help me make this connection of we're talking about this, but it really is a workforce challenge. I'm curious on your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Shelton. I think the idea around working conditions is real. It's real because we know that, and I want to put it in this space, that predominantly our teaching profession, especially in elementary schools, are female. And if you go deeper into early childhood and early childhood teachers, we're talking about 96%. So I think that we definitely have to have a conversation around training and respect and a conversation around working conditions, better working conditions. Our salary has not been up to just the standards. So I just want to put that in the space. So that's one. The other piece is that our educators are seeing that this profession is kind of like a pre-career to go into something else. Because as far as scaling up, teaching is the profession. Scaling up means they're leaving for better pay as an administrator or a superintendent. So I just want to bring that into context and just the idea that we have to do something better because we are losing our educators. Retention matters, especially when we're talking about if we're training. If they're leaving the first 5 years and we're talking about professional development costing approximately $50,000 a year, they leave, we lose that as well.
I think the other thing that we can talk about is something that many people often say is that they're not getting into teaching because of the pay, right? They're getting into teaching because they love education. They are passionate about education. But at the same time, salary matters. Getting cost of living increases matters in order to stay in the profession. And the other thing that matters is feeling supported. One of the ways that our educators can feel supported is by having ongoing professional learning and supports, including time in their day. And maybe that means that we're offering models about how to be more creative to allow for those kinds of time commitments and professional learning opportunities for our educators. It's important to note here that while many states went in the direction of eliminating lifetime teaching licenses in order to add professional learning requirements, in Wisconsin, we did the opposite. We used to have professional learning requirements for our educators, and we eliminated those in the favor of having lifetime licenses. And I think that that means that our educators don't have any incentive to continue professional learning, because if there's no incentive for them to continue that professional learning, why would they?
Okay. We're going to kind of hit you with a 1, 2, 3. I just want to get one last thing in on this, and then you can cut me off
real fast.
I promise I can do this.
We've kind of gotten way off topic here, to be honest.
Yeah, I think this will drive it back home for you, though. We don't have ladders in the career to incentivize people to become reading instructors, reading coaches. That lifetime license piece was the only ladder that existed, and we cut it off. So what is the incentive for somebody to want to learn these new skills? We're talking about the statutory mandates, but you know, what is the incentive for somebody to teach in a very high-need class where reading is going to be a legitimate real challenge? It doesn't exist. That's part of the problem.
Senator Johnson, I think, do you still have a question?
Get to go first. Thank you. I know you had said earlier that your professional learning funds were not present, right? In the budget, I thought you said something similar to that, that you needed additional dollars for professional learning funds. If there isn't money allocated for professional learning, then who pays for that, and how does the staff get those services?
It completely comes out of local funds, and so it's dependent upon the budget of each individual school district or independent charter school as well as the amount of time that they have.
So the schools are currently paying for that themselves rather than DPI?
Yes, DPI does offer some no-cost professional learning in the form of archived webinars on our website, because that's what we are able to offer equitably statewide, including a webinar series that I really want to highlight because I feel pretty excited about it. We have a whole webinar series currently on our site that highlights evidence-based early reading instructional practices. Unfortunately, it was published in school year 2020-2021, which was maybe not a great time to highlight such a high leverage resource.
How many coaches do we currently have right now in the system to that you can allocate to schools?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure. I know that our well-resourced districts employ their own coaches. I was absolutely happy to hear more details about Mississippi's model, and we would absolutely want to advocate for targeting any coaches that came through our appropriation to those schools that need it the most.
And one last question. I know that our last speaker talked about to ensure consistency and practice and quality that their coaches and things are through their kind of like DPI system. You mentioned earlier that something about the single ready reading screener, and I think she mentioned that too. But you also mentioned that I guess the schools use their own. So how many... Is it each individual district uses their own model or each individual schools, and exactly how many models are being used currently?
Currently, the way that our state statute is worded is that each individual school district and independent charter has the independent authority to select the reading readiness screener that they want to use. In theory, that means that they could select more than one and administer more than one, even across a school district or independent charter school system. What our data shows is that last year there were 36 different screeners that were used across the state.
Thank you. Those are all the questions I
have. Okay, Representative Duco.
Thank you. Actually, my question was somewhat answered. I'm sure you were in the room. I was interested in what Mississippi spends per student versus Wisconsin, and find out that we spend more than Florida and Mississippi. So I'm just curious if you know how they can do this more effectively with less money.
I think I would caution and just kind of give a giant pause on comparing state across systems, because there are some different intricacies to how people calculate funding. I do think there are some ways in which some of those states have figured out how to leverage grouping of federal funds in a way to support a targeted initiative like reading. So I think you're tipping on to something that we have been working on in this administration of how do we collectively harness all of that authority and power and use it in one consistent way. I would argue that if you are looking at that in a true apples-to-apples comparison, that would be the difference maker that you could make.
So you're saying that they have federal money that they're using?
I'm saying every state has federal money that they can use to target initiatives. So if you're asking if apples to apples was truly a thing that existed in those state finance numbers, which I don't believe, having dug in and researched, that they are truly apples to apples, if you're asking me what Florida and Mississippi has done from a funding perspective that Wisconsin could do a better job of, it is to align federal interventions and supports around a singular policy goal to try to drive improvements.
Thank you. I think I'll have to do some research on it myself.
Senator Sturble?
I'd follow up on that a little bit. Actually, looking at U.S. Census data, all funds, all sources, Wisconsin's at about 13,000 and Mississippi is about 9,200. So there's significant, that's per the U.S. Census data, all funds, all sources. So pretty clear there. I think it's we're 23rd, they're 47th. So, which I think bears out with her slide up there that showed that we spend about 37% more in education funding than they do. But one thing I want to talk about, you know, we're here to talk about, okay, how are we going to improve reading and what's the best technique to do that? And you talk about reading coaches and the resources and the things we're doing to improve reading. It kind of seems like we're beating the head against our head against the wall when we're really not using the right techniques. I mean, we can throw all the money in the world, and if we're not doing it the right way, we're not going to see results. I mean, do you agree? Am I crazy about that or what?
We absolutely agree, which is why we are advocating not only for a recommended instructional materials list, but also resources to address the how. How our educators use those materials in order to provide the instruction, to implement the evidence-based early reading instructional practices. And the same thing at higher ed, not only looking at the state statute to ensure that what we're requiring of our higher ed programs includes all of the components of early evidence-based early reading practices, but that we also are in the position of providing them with some of the how.
Well, it's kind of too bad that we've got the smartest people at our universities, and yet we have to create a law to tell them how to teach. I mean, I don't get that. You know, that's weird. You'd think they should be the ones who would know the innovative ways to teach, not that us legislators have to create legislation to tell them how to teach the way scientific data shows it should be taught. So I guess my point is that, you know, yes, blame it on universities, sure, but we're spending money on all these things and we're really not doing it right. So I guess the focus is, I mean, the $15 million they do a year, I mean, that's a drop in the bucket. But, you know, when you look at the overall spending and when you look at what we're spending now today to teach a curriculum that's ineffective, I think maybe we really want to focus on, okay, how do we, I'm sad to say, have to retrain our teachers from what they learned at the university system. And I think that should be our focus. And after that, I feel very confident that once our teachers have been trained properly, that they're going to be able to deliver this content and our kids are going to be able to excel. So I'm not sure, you know, if it's that much money that we're really even talking about here, considering when you look at the overall big picture on spending and kind of the fundamental flaw that we're really trying to tackle at this point in time. So I guess that's what I'd have to say. Thanks.
Okay, Senator Larson, and I hope we can keep it to discussing reading.
Yeah. Thank you. And I'm just kind of I appreciate this as we did end up pairing these things together. I didn't get a chance to ask the last speaker, you know, for the work that they did in the in Mississippi to be able to raise their scores. The question I asked, I guess it pertains to you too, is in you know, is the funding portion of it? Because I obviously, if we're just looking at just a sliver of time and then not looking at the whole picture, I think that ends up lending itself to giving us not the full information. And so just looking at, are you familiar? There's a website, National Center for Education Statistics, that kind of compares the different scores in terms of where we are in terms of reading. And I'm just scratching my head because as much as we're talking about what Mississippi has done, just looking at the data from 2019, it says that in fourth grade, Mississippi was higher than seven states compared to Wisconsin, which is higher than nine states. So we're pretty close already. But then when we go to eighth grade scores, you probably already know this. Do you know what happens? So Mississippi is higher than three states, and Wisconsin is higher than 36. So I think that there's, you know, as we're looking at where we are in terms of funding and being able to say what the overall picture is, it's, I mean, you can, you know, I think of the story that's told probably in across different religious disciplines about the story of the three blind men examining an elephant, right? And so you can look at a piece of it and say, my gosh, look at this. But I think it's worth looking at the whole picture. So my question is the impact of funding, as we're kind of, that seems to be the center of the universe that we are orbiting around. And I'm just curious, because again, even as we look at entire states, that is not equal across the board, right? right? And outcomes are not equal across the board. Heck, even per pupil funding is not equal across the board, as sure as heck isn't within my own school district. So I'm curious if you can talk about the correlation of disproportionate funding and the impact on reading scores.
Yeah, I mean, I have to acknowledge this before I start. What's the old adage? There are lies, damn lies, and statistics. I think you can find a number to support a lot of cases when you dive into education, funding, all of these other numbers games. But your question's a really good one, Senator Larson, because we have a funding system that was locked into place in 1993-94 based on how much people spent in that particular window of time. And if you fast forward or catapult into where we are right now in, I would argue, the modern world, things have changed. People in those schools look differently significantly. They have different needs. And yet we are locked into that spending pattern and habits.
We need to stay on track here, though. We're getting off again.
The disproportionality is massive, and it directly impacts how you're able to resource and fund reading at the local level. So you're talking about some districts having almost a $9,000 revenue limit. How are they going to make up the added difference between a Nicolet High School district that has an $19,000 revenue limit? Nicolet High School District is going to be able to employ more reading coaches, more direct reading supports. They're going to be able to upgrade their reading curriculum, whereas that $9,000 district is not going to have the same resources to target reading initiatives. So while it feels like you can pull these apart a little bit, it has a direct impact.
Okay, Senator Johnson, if you have a... Johnson, sorry.
Thanks.
A reading question.
Yep, just a quick follow-up. I think it's, as we're, the lesson as we're pulling it from Mississippi... is we're very much focused on what they did kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade. And I agree, and I think we all agree that what they did was amazing to be able to say that we are going to invest a concerted level of resources. And I really like that she said that it wasn't formulaic. They said we are going to devote this level of funds to it. So as much as we on this committee, I think, need to hear it, that there is, if we're going to be focused on one specific problem, we can change that one specific outcome. But Mr. Chair, with respect, if we're going to look at the entire educational ecosystem, it's worth looking at the entire elephant and not just an eyelash. So with that, I would say, would you agree that what Mississippi did and was able to do was because of those devoted level of resources over 10 years? I think we said $144.5 million, that it wasn't just we are going to give you a magic wand of a book on phonics, that it was the specialist that went along with it.
Real brief.
Yes. I mean, it's a both and approach, right? Like you're holding hands, right?
Okay, Senator Johnson, thank you.
I noticed that the last speaker. Well, first of all, the fact that in 2013 they spent $9.5 million to start their program, which was over 10 years ago. So my question to you is that I know you mentioned the 24 coaches, the $10 million, but our last speaker broke down some of the efforts that their money is being spent on. Like 61% was for literacy support, that one, and 17% statewide professional development, with an additional 15%, $2.2 million, for one readiness assessment for universal screeners. So my question to you is the $10 million that you're requesting, the 24 coaches that you're talking about hiring, is that going to be enough funding to implement these other things too? And I know she said that this money is in addition to the education funds that are already allocated. So if you look at the additional money that's spent just for your early learners, and that doesn't include the rest of the system, K through 12, it's just the early learners, roughly around how much, and I don't know if you can answer this, would DPI be looking at to implement a program similar to that that's in Mississippi? Is the $10 million going to be enough that you're requesting for the 24 coaches in order to implement a program to that extent?
So I think we were trying to cost something that would be reasonable and politically solvent. I think you heard Senator Strobel raising some very legitimate concerns around cost and ability to continue to fund things going forward. You want to talk about what it would take to do Mississippi and Wisconsin? Mississippi has an enrollment of around 450,000 kids. We have around 850, if you count privates and make them eligible, you're at about just under a million. So essentially double what Mississippi did if you want to do exactly what Mississippi did. You have a reasonable cost.
Okay, Senator Strobel.
Yeah, I want to talk about reading, but as long as we're hung up on finances, being on joint finance, I got to throw a few things out there, okay? And, well, first off, sorry. It is on. Okay. There was a comment made that Dr. Burke said about hiring retired people half-time. Well, you can actually hire retired people two-thirds time in Wisconsin, so keep that in mind. And they lose no retirement benefits whatsoever. But, again, just getting back to, I think we got to look at the big picture. We got to look at census data. We got to look at all funds, all sources, 13,000 to 9,000. So I think if we do things the right way, we can have better results. And I think we've seen studies that show you can spend a whole lot of money and sometimes you don't get any educational benefit whatsoever. And I think where we are with reading right now, teaching a flawed system that we have to change, I think we're seeing that in real time. So thanks.
Yeah, I would say change costs money. And I know that you're a gentleman who, I think you have some nice land, right? You own a house? Imagine that house. Imagine that house in Mississippi, and imagine how much the property value would deflate. I mean, there is a real difference in economy between the state of Mississippi and the state of Wisconsin, and not acknowledging that is disingenuous. I mean, I think there are different economic circumstances in the states that cause costs to do business to look completely different.
I agree. I'm not sure if we agree on the same things. So, thanks.
Okay. Representative Considine?
We've had earlier a bunch of discussion about curriculum, and I wanted to, and I'm glad you addressed that somewhat. But I want to talk a little bit about, I think Wisconsin is really ahead of the curve in our academic standards, for reading especially. I was sitting here reading those today, and we're a local control state, but our academic standards for reading, I think, model what I have heard suggested. I went to the thing last week. Is exactly what our standards suggest. They are a combination of science of reading, balanced literacy, whatever you want to call it, but they're not a specific one. But they address every skill and at each grade level, what a child needs to know phonetically and about phonemes, in addition to word recognition, in addition to comprehension at every level from kindergarten through 12th grade. How do we get those academic standards? Because I really think that's what we need to do, is get those academic standards that we already have to drive our instruction.
Yes. So the first thing that I will say is that thank you for recognizing the very robust academic standards that we have in the state. One thing that I want to point out is that our standards in the area of reading foundational skills, which are based on evidence-based reading instructional practices, go through fifth grade. So we do also, just referring back to an earlier part of the day today, when we were really referencing the fact that we can't stop teaching reading at third grade. Our academic standards reflect that we need to continue instruction in the teaching of reading through fifth grade. And I think that's part of why we are more interested in criteria for instructional materials rather than specific titles. Obviously, our criteria would lead to specific titles and a recommended list of specific titles, but that's exactly why it's so important to start with the criteria. And one of our criteria would be those robust academic standards that we have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to springboard on, thank you for coming today. I really appreciate it. I wanted to springboard on something that you just said about continued instruction after the third and fourth grade. I learned at one time that after the fourth grade, not a whole lot was done if readers hadn't gotten it by then. So can you address just a little bit about what you do to help people who haven't gotten it by the third or fourth grade to catch up? Because if the emphasis is just on reading up to the third and fourth grade, they haven't gotten it, they don't have a chance to read to learn for the rest of their educational experience or the rest of their life. So can you explain a little bit about interventions that are done for people who haven't gotten it by the third or fourth grade, please?
Yeah, I won't go into a whole lot of weedy detail about that here, but what I will say is that this question is also wrapped up in our statutorily required handbook for dyslexia and related conditions. And one of the things that we offer in that handbook are a series of questions that educators should ask, questions that families should ask about reading and reading instruction. And if I have a child in front of me who is in the fourth grade and who is not performing in the area of reading, the first thing that I need to do is I need to figure out why, which probably means that I need to engage in some more diagnostic testing, because I need to know the exact underlying issues. And we haven't even talked about diagnostic testing here today, but that is absolutely a really important piece of the puzzle. And that's actually something that the state of Michigan does, is not only do they require that reading readiness screener for all students, they also have a requirement where for students that perform below benchmark on that screener, the educators are further required to engage in diagnostic screening to really accurately identify what are the underlying issues so that they can be addressed, because it's not the same for every child. And I think that's really important to note. Also related to this conversation is the fact that not all screeners are built the same, right? We know that some screeners that exist on the market today are computer adaptive, which means that you have a child answers the question one way, and that determines whether or not their next question is more difficult or easier. And what that means is that if I have two children who have the same score, that does not mean they have the same reading needs at all. I need to dig further into that.
Final question, I think, Representative Shelton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will make this quick. I generally have a question about Forward and NAEP. It's my understanding that those two assessments broadly assess comprehension and not decoding and phonics, not reading itself. So I am curious, twofold. One is, if those assessments give us an accurate picture of where Wisconsin students are today and their reading ability as it pertains to phonics and decoding, and two, if the state was to make any changes in the program and to shift and support our teachers and do all the things we've talked about, would we then also have to look at our assessments to make sure that they continue to give us the best data and information moving forward?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Our assessments from third grade on up are absolutely assessments of comprehension. And we use comprehension as a proxy, right, for making some kind of guesses about the reading ability and the reading foundational skills that our students have. Those reading readiness screeners are the ones that that are really more focused from 4K through grade 2 are the assessments that are more focused on identifying those underlying reading foundational skills, which is why they're so critical. And we do know that the assessment that we currently have in place is not an assessment of reading between grades 3 and 8. It is an assessment of English language arts, which includes reading comprehension and writing and the application of a certain kind of grammar, academic grammar, and listening. And so right now, the way that our test is constructed, we can't really pull reading out of that. But I will say that that is a move that we are looking to make moving into the future. We're currently in a position where we are beginning to have discussions about constructing a new state summative assessment that would allow us to have a reading-specific component for students in grades 3 through 8.
Just to follow up, if we move to a standard reading readiness screener, would that data help us to better understand the students' decoding and phonics ability in the grades up leading up to third grade?
If you have the tools to know how to act on that data, yes. I think it comes down to that, right? Because just having a score, right, does not necessarily mean that I have the knowledge and expertise to know how to appropriately intervene. So having that data is valuable and could absolutely tell us some things. But for the teacher in the classroom, it's all about having the tools to be able to act on that data. So it's a both and, I guess.
Okay, thanks so much for coming in, and thank you for your patience and working with our shift there a little bit, and plan to continue to work with you. So thanks.